All right, we are going to get started. Good morning, and thank you to everybody for attending, especially you, Susan. If you weren't here, this would be a lot harder job for me, so appreciate it. This is session number 324. If the shoe doesn't fit, do I still have to wear it? I'm glad I'm moderating this because I would bet that I wear the biggest shoe here. It is size 16. Yeah, by the reaction, I think that, yes, I wear the biggest shoe here. Before we begin, we do have a few announcements. Please silence your phones. We ask that they don't ring. That's all. Pretty simple. The session is being recorded, and you will be able to have access to it after Sunstone ends. At the registration desk on the main floor is where you can get that. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to Sunstone Magazine and podcast at the registration desk as well. And a special Saturday morning session announcement at Signature Books over yonder. Yonder is 100 meters, if you didn't know that that was the measurement. During lunch from 12:30 to 2 p.m., the Signature Books authors will be there signing their books. So you're welcome to go and get a copy of the books and have it signed. Stephen Carter, I'm new to this whole thing, so if I mispronounce anything, especially if you're in the room, I apologize. Deja Early, D. Michael Quinn, Daniel Stone, and Gary Bergera? Yes. Did I screw anyone else's up? Perfect. Now I just got to get yours right, and we're good to go. So we're very excited to have Susan here with us today, and we'd like to please give a warm welcome to Susan Hinckley.
See if I can not hold this because I got a lot going on up here already. This is my maiden voyage with PowerPoint. It has been keeping me awake for approximately 3 months. My walking partner is in the room. She can attest to that. I'm not sure we've talked about anything else for 3 months except will my PowerPoint work and will I know what to do when I get there. So changing the slides is going to be enough for me. So if you can't hear me, then holler at me. I asked Alan to sort of skip the intro, because by the third day, like the intro thing is getting a little canned, and there is a moral to that story. The moral of the story is not rocket science, and that is, like, you should not present all 3 days of Sunstone. That is stupid. And I've learned some things from it, though. Like, if you do, things will happen to you. You will get a giant zit on your face at some point in the 3 days. You will not sleep, so by the third day, you will be incredibly sleep-deprived and a little punchy. But you will also be overcome by the outpouring of support from friends and people in this community. It's just a wonderful space, and I feel honored to be here to share my story with you. I'm a huge believer in the power of story. Story is the thing that connects us. I believe that our stories can change the world. I certainly believe that they can heal this church. And so I'm going to share my story with you today. There is nothing inherently that exciting or powerful about my story, except that I believe that in a community like Mormonism, where so few of us feel at liberty to actually bring our story with us, all stories are powerful and can make a difference. Our stories can make room for more stories. And I feel that that is the way that the church is going to step forward into our next phase. So I'll go first. Shoe clearance racks have taught me an important truth. You can find really great shoes on clearance if you wear a size 6. If you wear an 8... you're only going to find the things that you would expect to find on clearance because nobody else wants them either. The average American woman has a shoe size between 8.5 and 9. Shoes, like most things, generally look cuter in a 6 than they do in a 9. But squeezing into them, even when it is possible, isn't a viable answer if you actually want to walk anywhere in them. The consequences of trying to wear shoes that don't fit over time are measured in pain, bunions, foot deformities, and joint issues. Small shoes can create big problems. As much as I wish it fit, off-the-rack, in-season Mormonism has always fit me a little bit like a size 6 shoe. There are some lucky women that naturally wear a six comfortably, but what about the rest of us? We show up at church every week. The salesmen trot out a stack of boxes full of perfect sixes. We all admire them because generally they do look great. Who doesn't want cute tiny feet? We jam as much of our foot in as we can. We squirm around for 3 hours, pretending that they fit. And then we hobble out to our cars, where we kick the shoes off and rub our blisters, determined that we will try to keep them on longer next time. If I wanted to describe my lifetime of Sundays in one sentence, I could borrow it from Popeye's olive oil. I wear a six, but a 10 feels so good. As a kid, my Sunday shoes were often the first sign of a growth spurt. One week they'd fit, and the next week I'd pull on my tights, or Susie Long Legs, as my mother called them, only to find that the crotch only came halfway up my thigh. That was annoying in and of itself, but sometimes it meant something worse. I would be wedging my foot into newly shrunk patent leather Mary Janes, and I was not going to be able to take them off for hours. Why didn't I ever remember to try my Sunday shoes on Wednesday? You can't get new shoes on a Sunday morning in Salt Lake City in 1970, even if your foot has grown a full inch during the week. And not wearing Sunday shoes to church was never an option. I remember feeling ashamed of those ill-fitting tights and shoes, hoping that none of the other kids could see the things that weren't right. As I think back, that was more important than my own discomfort. I'd bear the pain, but I did not want anyone else to see when things didn't fit. I've been at this game for a while now. My feet are tired of being sore. They're beginning to demand custom shoes. They've become cranky about wearing something just because someone else says they should. I can't even get my metaphorical shoes on some days, and a simple shoehorn won't help. My feet are complicated. Wide with questions, anxiety, depression, fear, creative impulses, overthinking, unique challenges, a few hard knocks, messy love, and a heart that sometimes refuses to obey me. My feet were always going to need roomy shoes. I first remember complaining about church as a very young child. Sundays were long. I was not allowed to play outside or with friends. I was not allowed to watch TV. I was required to stay in a dress. I realized that Fast Sunday was the opposite of fast. The state conference was downright interminable. For years on Sunday morning, as I was having the curlers wrestled from my hair, I would ask, "But it isn't state conference, is it? How long until state conference?" Because I guess I needed to adjust my dread accordingly. I can hardly remember a time when I didn't spend half the week being relieved that Sunday was over and the other half unhappily eyeing its approach. Getting older should have helped, but instead, the problems progressed from normal childhood boredom to doctrinal disagreement at an alarming pace. I was barely 10 years old the day I stepped up on a chair, shook my fist at a confused Sunday school teacher, and said with great fervor, "I have no interest in being a baby factory for eternity. I'm not going to the celestial kingdom." He was unimpressed by this declaration. It wasn't long before I began confiding to my friends that polygamy was way too unfair to girls for anyone to believe in. I felt like if I was smart enough to see something so obvious, surely God could see it too. I'm not sure the other kids worried so much about polygamy, but it was one generation closer to me than it was to most members, and it created a disconnect that my mind could not reconcile. It was like the first time that you learn about the Holocaust. And it's just too big and awful to even get your mind around. I spent a lot of time turning polygamy over in my young head. I could see that I would need a locked closet to keep it in, so I built one. By about age 12, I had a Sunday school teacher who nicknamed me Drano Mouth because, as he explained, I had a caustic personality. He was not entirely wrong. It was a different Sunday school teacher, by the way. it was, you know, so like the problems continued, obviously. But he wasn't entirely wrong. For some reason, Sunday school lessons did not seem to bring out the best in me. They did push my buttons, though. By the time I was a teen, I started kicking a lot of rules to see which bent and which broke. I'd secretly had more than one boyfriend before I turned 16. I was relatively well-behaved with them, but every sneaky phone call or meeting was a rebellious little kick at the monolithic dating rule. Once I was actually allowed to date, 98% of my choices were not eligible for the parental stamp of approval, which may or may not have been a large part of their appeal. I had a lot of questions brewing about the world, and somehow living right on the edge of trouble felt like the closest thing to an answer that I could access at the time. I was also keenly interested in the women's lib movement, and not just because it made the Mormons in the room uncomfortable. My father once complained that being my child would be difficult and confusing because you would never be sure whether Santa Claus was a man or a woman. I'm pretty sure that he was talking about more than Santa Claus, and I guess I wasn't very careful about keeping even my most dangerous big thoughts to myself. My mother worked full-time, and it had saved her mental health, and it had helped our family in very real ways. I was convinced it was something every woman should have the right to do, and I was loud about that belief. Every time my young women's leaders tried to talk to me about traditional Mormon motherhood, I informed them, not always kindly, that I had other ideas. I stopped attending seminary in the middle of 10th grade, convinced that I had more important things to do than watch Johnny Lingo during fourth period. I stand by that assessment, by the way. Instead, I took on extra academic classes so that I could graduate from high school a year early. It was the quickest way that I could see out of my Utah childhood. I was eager to make some life choices for myself. And I made plans to run away to design school in California. My friends at that time would have voted me the most likely to be single at 35. I'd made it very clear that I wanted God himself to be biting his nails, wondering if it was ever going to happen. I insisted on attending Relief Society instead of Young Women's after I graduated, even though I was only 16. And I had to fight the bishop to do it. He wanted me with the rest of the girls my age. I wanted to be with the adults. Their lessons were much more interesting to me than talking about marriage. I was working at a bank that summer and saving money for my escape when one Sunday the bishop called me into his office and wanted to strike a bargain. He would stop giving me grief about going to Relief Society if I would agree to attend the U of U for one quarter, just one quarter to see if I liked it, and then he said I could do whatever I wanted with his blessing. I have absolutely no idea why I listened, but in a rare moment of compliance, I agreed, and I registered for the U. When I got to the U, in my first class on the first day, I saw a guy wearing a Welsh fishing smock. I thought it was one of the weirdest things I had ever seen. It looked exactly like his mother had made it for him, but there was also something kind of endearing about that. He was wearing John Lennon's National Health glasses also, and the whole getup somehow had this really curious effect on me. The teacher had us all go around and introduce ourselves. It was a Charles Dickens class, and when it was his turn, he proudly announced that he'd just returned from living in England for 2 years. And I knew, of course, that was code for, I'm a newly returned missionary. I was both intrigued by that fact and completely hated myself for being so. Far be it from me to walk into that kind of obvious trap, but something about him inspired a new, never-before-considered awful idea for a different kind of rebellion. And here I like to imagine that part in The Grinch where he smiles his grinchy idea smile and it runs evilly all the way up until it curls the tip of his scheming head. Wouldn't it be hilarious if I, the walking rebellion, started dating the Mormoniest Mormon who ever Mormoned? It turned out his name was even Hinckley, which was just, like, too good to be true. I went home that day, and I called my mother at work, and I bet her I could get a date with him. Having known me longer than I know myself, she bet me $5 that I couldn't, but we're not going to take time to analyze the implications of that in the mother-daughter relationship. It was game on. It was a nail-biter, too. We got down to finals week before he asked me out. I think he'd already dated his way halfway through the class before he got around to me. On our first date, he told me I was R.A., RA was mission lingo for someone who had a rotten attitude about the church. I should have been insulted, and I would have if he hadn't been so obviously right. He didn't even know that I would secretly take that as a compliment. He also did not know that I was only 17. I seemed to forget that part, too, the more we hung out. Pretty soon we were inseparable. I'm quite sure that he thought he could reform me. He now knows that he was wrong. The joke was on him. But it was also on me. For some reason, the more I was around him, the more I found I kind of wanted to be reformed. After an entire childhood spent feeling like a dyed-in-the-wool, true-blue Mormon misfit, like perhaps I'd landed in someone else's life by mistake because I was all questions, but everyone around me seemed to be satisfied with answers, I saw for the first time a possibility that maybe, just maybe, I could one day fit. I saw in him the kind of spiritual ease that I had only ever dreamed of, and I thought that if I got close enough to it, maybe it could rub off on me. Lest you judge me too harshly, I was fully 18 before we got married. Okay, you can judge me, and I deserve your judgment, but I don't care what you think. I will also argue that I was halfway through the U of U, and the guy was so much better than anyone else that I had ever brought home or shown any interest in, that aside from being a bit embarrassed, or if I'm honest, horrified by my age, my parents were thrilled by my choice. I think they hoped that he might reform me too. So they supported my crazy backhanded rebellion. After all, it was mostly rebellion against myself. What parent doesn't enjoy seeing a kid eat just about every word they've ever said in one good meal? I didn't understand it at the time, but on some deep level, I really needed to make a place for my uncomfortable self at the Mormon table, and I hoped I'd found it. He was everything I wasn't. I thought our marriage could finally bridge my gaps. The doubts and questions and disconnects that plagued me would surely recede once I'd committed to the answers. Besides, in this decision, I actually felt God's hand in my life. We'd only been married a month or so the day he came home and told me that the bishop asked if we would speak in sacrament meeting, and he'd said yes, without asking me. When I told him that he would be calling the bishop back to say no, he was unhappy and a little bewildered. It never occurred to him that he would need to ask me first. It made sense that the bishop would go through him. But the assigned date coincided with school deadlines that I had, and I was furious. It remains the biggest fight that we've ever had, except for the one about mending socks that happened about a week later and shared many common themes. I realized in that moment that I was married to a Mormon man, and that even the best Mormon men had come up through the same system I had. There were norms and expectations, things that neither one of us had ever even specifically thought about or analyzed, except for the vague understanding that many of them rubbed me wrong. It turned out being married was not going to change that. In that first ward, we'd sit in gospel doctrine class behind the elders' quorum president and his wife, who had the cutest little golden-headed girl that I have ever seen. She was magical. We had graduate school ahead, and we had agreed that children weren't anywhere near the immediate picture. But watching that beautiful baby and her mama, it was perfectly clear to me I would need one of those if I wanted to actually fit in. And I wanted to start fitting in right now. Perhaps I was panicky that I thought marriage was going to fix my Mormon disconnect, but I could already see it wasn't. To this day, I can't fully explain it, but it happened that at the ripe old age of 19, I had both my baby and my college degree. Nobody could have been more surprised than I was. By age 25, I had 3 children. We looked like the most perfectly perfect little Mormon family that ever was, and why not? But being happily and miraculously married to the right man, tacking on the name Hinckley, and plunking 3 kids on the bench between us hadn't really fixed a thing about my Mormonism. We were living in Minnesota, and although I'd always hoped that just leaving Utah would solve a lot of my problems, the painful, demoralizing, and inexplicable chafing continued. I had a hard adjustment settling into motherhood. I didn't get a paycheck. I didn't get a report card. Some days I didn't really get to leave the house. I won't go into the reasons that I decided to be a stay-at-home mother. I had very personal reasons. They didn't have anything to do with church teachings, and I wholly believed in my choice. But it took me fully 9 years of kicking and squirming to get comfortable in that role. I didn't talk much about that with my Mormon friends. It wasn't the kind of thing that young Mormon mothers were talking about in the 1980s, at least not in the wards that I found myself in. My kids grew. I served in primary, raised my eyebrows at some of the song lyrics, but generally enjoyed having a place to hide and eat snacks. Taught Relief Society, mourning the death of cultural refinement and social relations lessons. Sang in ward choirs where the whole canon of sacred music from which I was used to singing was sneakily being replaced by a single hymn book. I stuffed all my disquiet in the closet. We were living in Chicago when the September 6 excommunications happened, and I found myself reeling. I didn't expect the depth of sadness that I experienced, but every time a voice was silenced, it somehow felt deeply personal to me. Was it my imagination, or was the church that had always fit too tightly becoming even smaller? Around this time, I taught a Relief Society lesson bearing one of my favorite themes, that creativity is next to godliness. I told them it wasn't an overstatement to say that creative self-expression saved my life as an ill-suited young mother drowning in boredom and Mormon culture and depression. And we can talk more about Big D in a moment, but one day, a week or so later, my doorbell rang and there was a woman standing at the door with an outstretched arm and an embroidered dish towel, weeping. I didn't know her well. She was much older than I was, and she simply handed me the towel, which bore my motto, "Creativity Saves Lives," explaining that just hearing me talk about my struggle in Relief Society had somehow saved her. She'd gone home and embroidered it on a towel for each of us so that neither one of us would forget. I think it was the first time I glimpsed that perhaps I was not the only person who was suffocating, feeling wedged into a space they deeply wanted to fit or sort of wanted to or felt like they had to, but also yearning to breathe. I decided to stretch and test my own boundaries a bit, so I went on a couple of retreats with the Midwest Pilgrims, and the breath of fresh air felt like a possible rebirth to me. How had I never realized there were so many other women who shared my uneasy relationship with Mormonism? Before I had time to do much more than admire the seeds of that idea as they were planted, a sudden job change took us away from the Midwest. I tucked the revelation in my pocket to fortify me as I faced reinventing myself in a new ward in a new part of the country. I was hopeful, and part of that hope was because I had a small sense of the power and possibility of better understanding myself and therefore my true place. We hadn't been in our Seattle home long before it became clear that even the most perfect children don't always do exactly what you want them to do. Our sixth grader had an independent and rebellious streak about a mile wide. Hardly a surprise, but she also didn't care who knew it, even in our ward. And I was shocked to realize how much I did care. I was bewildered, vaguely guilt-ridden, and ashamed. I did not want to be judged as a Mormon mom who wasn't Mormon enough to keep her children in line. As I tell it now, I still can't even believe how much it mattered to me. I felt like I'd already given so much more to the church than I wanted to give most of my life. Where were the rewards? I thought I was doing a splendid job of teaching my girls to think carefully, to seek a personal confirmation before accepting what they heard at church, but then to lean into key doctrines when their hearts revealed truths. I thought I was creating a much larger space for them than the one I'd allowed myself to occupy, one that fit, one that they would never outgrow. But it had not occurred to me they might not choose to be in that space at all, nor how much it mattered to me whether they did or didn't. Around this time, our girls got involved in competitive swimming. And by involved, I mean it took over our entire lives. They were all equally engaged was a wonderful stroke of luck. We spent huge chunks of family time in the car and at the pool. We traveled to meets on weekends, and that included Sunday, and it seemed right. It was time spent together doing something we all loved. We saw positive results in every area of our family life. Even our rebellious kid was suddenly thriving within the lines. But people started to notice when we weren't at church. I found myself caught in a confusing rub of something that felt right and was throwing off obvious benefits to my family against the suspicions and worries of ward members. And then another move came. This one was to Central Florida and was armed with a hefty dose of culture shock. I believe I could have lived in the South forever and never felt at home there. Somehow our particular area seemed steeped in behaviors and attitudes that were utterly foreign to me. For one thing, racism was alive and well, including in high places in our ward and stake. This was a huge challenge for our family. We had never encountered racism up close before, and we certainly didn't expect to find it at church. The seminary teacher used the N-word. The kids in the ward wouldn't speak to my daughters because they ate lunch with black kids at school. The bishop called us in and tried to justify it all with cooked-up theological explanations that we knew were absolutely wrong, and we said so. Sexism was rampant, too, in strangely open ways. It seemed to step between me and my leaders again and again, resulting in friction, contempt, and open hostility from ward members toward me and my girls. The young men's president and the young women's president weren't on speaking terms. And as the first counselor, I was stuck in the middle, trying to run a program that felt so broken it threatened to damage every kid in its reach. If I hadn't felt at home as a Mormon before, I now felt like I was from a completely different planet. Our oldest daughter had some particularly painful experiences. Her later rejection of the church had a lot to do with those years. I couldn't even blame her for it. My own experiences were so bad. One night, I found myself eye to eye with a message that I could see blinking clearly. This is how people leave. For the first time in my life, I felt I had a decision to make. But then suddenly the path changed again. And just in the nick of time, we found ourselves in the Midwest for a fourth stint. We settled into the familiarity of it gratefully, but I was wounded from my Florida experiences, and I determined that I would hold the church and its members at arm's length for a while. My emotional distance manifested itself in funny ways. I was working as an artist, and I embraced the role of crazy artist lady in our ward, coming to church wearing things like my red peace sign cowboy boots just to keep people a little bit off balance. I got an offer to hang a show in a gallery space at a lesbian bookstore, and I invited the bishop to the opening with a mixture of glee and trepidation. He came and stayed all evening, offering unfailing support with a mixture of good humor and friendship. I guess some people refused to recognize the outsider status that I was trying so hard to assign myself. Instead of settling into the fringes, I landed in stake callings for nearly a decade. Although it was primary and didn't capitalize on my strengths, I both enjoyed the work and I loved the people that I served with. But I also embraced the anonymity of not completely belonging anywhere. It was a large stake geographically, and those callings required a lot of travel. Nomadic Sundays became a comfort to me. I was enlarging my space, but maybe not in the best ways. I created just enough breathing room for myself that it allowed me to survive. During this time, my children's steps into adulthood took them places I had never expected, redefining everything I thought my Mormon family would look like. Our first daughter married an older man who had full custody of his two children, suddenly becoming a mother at 19 and making me a grandmother at 38. Wasn't what we would have chosen, but when he joined the church, he promised he'd take her to the temple in a year. It was an unconventional path that led to a familiar place, and so the whole family got behind them with hopeful hearts. Instead, he was abusive to both her and the children, and when we physically rescued her from that marriage in the middle of an awful night 2 years later, we were all disillusioned and heartbroken. Our middle daughter married a man who also had a daughter. After losing the first two grandchildren that we had so grown to love, it seemed like a lot to ask of our hearts, but again, we jumped behind them with both feet. They were married in the temple, and I was surprised at the relief I felt, as if her choices were somehow a validation of my own worth as a Mormon mother, or even more ludicrous, as if it were any kind of guarantee. Even as a lifelong struggler, my desire to hit the correct cultural benchmarks was astonishing to me, obviously planted somewhere very deep. As much as I fought it, I couldn't seem to help it. When our third daughter married, she chose to marry a member in the temple, but he also had a 3-year-old. 14 months later, he came home from work one night and announced he had found someone else and would be moving out immediately. Things were not turning out the way anyone expected they would. My husband wondered where the returned missionaries were. We'd raised strong women who didn't exactly fit the mold themselves, but we were proud of that. But couldn't our family have resembled the ideal a little more closely? I was afraid he somehow blamed me, as if the strange picture that was developing had afforded him a glimpse into the secret closet that I'd built to house my doubts and discomfort so many years before. Of course, I couldn't Mormon right, no matter how hard I tried. I was RA, remember? That never changed. My religion and I were mismatched from the start. Those were some hard years, as real life hit in full force and we struggled to understand how all the things we'd done right yielded enormous goodness and beauty and love that were very real, yet didn't look anything like we expected them to, or deep in our hearts thought they should, I guess, even though intellectually we understood that we really had no control whatsoever over the outcome of our own lives, let alone the lives of our children. It took some time to get our collective footing in this space. Luckily, we found it together. As adults, two of my three children are no longer in the church at all. The third dangles precariously. I raised them to be nuanced thinkers, but there is no degree of nuance that has been able to sustain them in Mormonism. They have irreconcilable differences with the church in policy and feel little spiritual connection to the doctrine. Although they all agree that Mormonism afforded them a pretty idyllic childhood, they refuse to squeeze their adult feet into their kid-sized shoes. I've experienced their disaffection with Mormonism in different ways. I was not surprised when the first left, yet mourned inexplicably as if something in my life had died. When the second left, I was quite surprised, but not nearly as sad. Some days, I almost felt jealousy that she fully trusted her own feet and her feet walked away. As for the third, she is a single divorced woman struggling to find happiness in a married church. I know it's a lot to ask. I'm not asking it. What I do want for her is to find just the right space for herself in the world and then fully inhabit that space as her whole self. It's the same thing I want for myself, the thing I've always wanted, but for me, in the end, it seems that will mean fully inhabiting my Mormonism. And now a word about depression. I've spent a good deal of my life in dark spaces and anxious hallways. Personal journals of my ancestors and the lives of my mother, grandmother, and now daughters point to the fact that this somehow came as part of my original equipment, but it makes Mormonism challenging. Even as a child, I knew I didn't feel a lot of connection to joy or happiness in the ways I heard those words used at church. And Mormonism can be a difficult place to navigate if depression and anxiety are integral to your experiences. I live daily with hefty doses of fear and a perennially unquiet mind. So I've spent a lot of my life thinking, what are they talking about whenever the topic turns to joy at church? I don't understand lasting joy on a very fundamental level. And I even try to imagine a next life in which some perfected me would brim with joy. And I can't imagine that either, because I can't imagine how it could be me. But despite the mental health challenges, I'm happy being me. Bertolt Brecht wrote, "In the dark times, will there also be singing?" Yes, there will also be singing about the dark times. My walk with depression has fueled a lot of my creative life over the years. I don't know many things, but I do know I was made this way. God understands me, and therefore, it's okay. So at this stage of my life, it has become clear to me that my inability to fit has perhaps had as much or more to do with me as with the church. It's big of me to admit that. I am not the victim of this story. I'm also not sure either one of us is willing to change. The best I can hope for is that we can get more comfortable with each other. So much of what we live with in the church is perpetuated only because we keep agreeing to live with it. And I've lived with feeling cramped for too long. My personal Mormon story is one of chronic depression, doctrinal questions, social anxiety, unresolved feminist complaints, thinking about it all way too much, and never, ever showing up as myself, And that last line is so important. What happened to the 10-year-old girl who jumped up on the chair and defiantly shook her fist the first time she heard an idea that her heart just couldn't agree with? I wish I had an answer, but I don't. Never quite at home, and I'm a lifer, all pieced together from pioneer stock on my side and then grafted into the closest thing we have to Mormon royalty through marriage. I can't imagine how difficult I might have found it to feel welcome if I had stumbled in off the street by way of a tattoo parlor. But sometimes I wish I had, just so I could have somewhere to place the blame. For whatever reason, fear, hope, desire, misplaced faith, or just misunderstanding, I've spent a lifetime making myself small in Mormonism. For years, I tried to keep my questions and needs neat and tidy enough to fit inside my Mormon shoes. I did it for my parents. I did it for my husband. I did it for my children. I felt ashamed for the parts of me that spilled over the edges, so I would tuck and tuck and tuck. I thought I could atone for my poor fit by trimming the troublesome parts of myself. Until one day, about 4 years ago, I knew I was either going to kick off the shoe or the blister would kill me. For one thing, once your kids have left it, Mormonism loses a lot of its luster. Ceding control of what I thought we were supposed to be and instead embracing our very real, whole selves has resulted in the growth of a lifetime for me. It required entirely new shoes. I can't go to church every week now and ratify the same old ideal without at least giving a nod to the fact that my own beautiful family hasn't turned out that way. And I'm a better person for what that reality has required of me. So I've started opening my mouth, and the relief has been life-saving and hope-saving. I don't know why I look so much worse after my baptism, by the way, than I do at the beginning, but I think it's hilarious. I'd never noticed till I got putting this slideshow together. Don't read too much into that. At the same time, as I've contemplated all of this, I've realized that in that rub between the shoe and the foot, in that wrestle, in that chafing, I am also made better. There is value for me even in the blister. There is value for me in the parts that pinch. There are lessons about love for myself and for others. There has been actual joy, that most elusive of emotions, in coming to understand that although I was not made to fit comfortably, still, I own the same portion of Mormonism that everyone else who steps into the baptismal font can claim. I've decided I've spent my life looking at it wrong. I was thinking I had to find truth as it was handed to me in a box, something small and sanitized, far away from the vibrant thoughts and feelings and questions that actually fuel our days and relationships and our spiritual interactions and personal experience with the divine in our lives. Boxes are finite. But personally, I have always known something is true when it makes me realize that the world is bigger than I thought it was. This is the feeling that most reliably speaks truth to my heart. Why then has it taken me a lifetime to understand that the church, if it is to contain any truth at all, must also be bigger than we think it is? The church, our church, is meant to help us become better versions of ourselves, not to help us pretend to be someone else entirely. If we are created in God's image, then God understands our feet and knows precisely what is required to fit them. Why would we assume God wears a perfect six when so few of us can? As long as I'm a Mormon, there's room for Mormons like me. Every time I show up, I create space for myself. If I show up small, that creates less space than if I show up in full, claiming all the room I need now and to grow in the future, and also stretching a bit, using my elbows to create extra room for the person sitting next to me, or the one who doesn't even feel they can fit through the door. I feel a bit like Dorothy, being told that she's had the answer all along and has only to click her heels to be home. She didn't waste time being angry for the difficulties that she'd gone through. She took that new piece of knowledge, clicked her heels with it, and went. Surely the point of any church is giving us the materials to make our own shoes that will help us walk through life better. Not that we are all given a woman's size 6 and asked to trim off the parts of our feet that don't fit. Bespoke Mormonism, At last, after we have remade it, it will feel like it is custom made for us. Surely this is what is meant by a personal relationship with God, with Christ, with faith. This is what is meant by that thing we're fond of saying about not being able to ride on someone else's testimony. It all must be made to fit you. And of course, me. Slipping into someone else's shoes was never going to be the answer. I hope that in sharing my own journey, I can give permission to others to share theirs. In our stories is the space we need to continue to thrive and grow here. We each wear the complexity of being a Mormon, which has nothing to do with believing or not, or doctrine or not, or culture or policy, or anything else decided by anyone else, but instead develops within the context of our individual lives and experience. Mine feels closer to fitting than it ever has before, and I'm feeling hopeful for the future. Perhaps the pinched feet of my Mormon childhood will soon be just a part of my story and not the whole of it. I'll close with a poem that I wrote some years ago about childhood, but it applies here too. It seems I've been swinging my patent leather feet from this same bench for centuries, never really understanding what the people in charge are talking about most of the time, but still wanting to be sitting here in this same spot, listening to my mother singing a beloved hymn on one side and my dad singing on the other. And last of all, here is the thing I need to say. It was so lonely, I could never leave myself alone there, so I stayed. But now, I cannot seem to go. I cannot seem to find my shoes. Thank you.
I feel the applause went on for longer than expected and not long enough.
Thank you.
Susan, thank you so much. We do have time for questions. I have a few myself, but I'll open it up to everyone here. We still have about another 15 minutes, so plenty of time for questions.
I didn't really expect there to be any, but if there are, I'm happy to take a shot at it.
And as you come up, please tell us your name. Thank you.
I'm Cynthia. Susan knows my name. So, Susan, two questions. One, what happened 4 years ago where you said, I'm going to start speaking up? And two, has it worked? Do you have evidence that it has helped the people around you feel more included?
I'm going to go from the back on that question. I have really concrete evidence that it has helped. So I teach Relief Society in my ward, and it's always a tap dance when I teach, which I'm sure anyone else who teaches in here probably understands. They hand me a conference talk, and I look and I go, no, 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 oh, okay, no, no, no. And then, so I take the one line that was okay, right, and then I do my thing with it. And I've only been called into the bishop's office once, for the record. And that was a lesson about priesthood, which is, like, infuriating to me. Anyway, that is a whole other story. That will be my session next year at Sunstone. But no, every time I do this tap dance, I have women come. Every time I have women come to me, every time. I have emails, I have phone calls, I have someone who stops me in the hall, something who says, thank you. Thank you. So it is making a difference. I just feel like our Relief Society, and I've only been in my ward 5 years, but I felt a change in it in the time that I've been there. I'm not going to take full credit for that. I think that as a church, we're moving in that direction anyway. People are opening, things are opening, things are happening. But I was there at the right time, kind of on the cusp of this change, and I've been able to push it forward a little bit in my ward, is really what I feel like. As to what happened 4 years ago, it was really about 5 years ago, kind of, that it really started. And I talked a little bit about that on the panel the first night of when I woke up that day and I didn't believe in an afterlife anymore, and so the wheels just kind of came off. And then after that was when my third daughter who got married and whose husband had an affair 14 months into their temple marriage, when that happened. I just couldn't. I'm like, this is the third. what is wrong with, what is going on? It really threw me for a loop. I had to figure out how to deal with it. I had to get down and wrestle with it. So I did. Thanks, Cynthia.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Thanks. And if you do want to come up and not say your name, that's okay too. I'm Alan still. My question is, listening and I have never been around or heard in depth a story like yours, and that's just the novelty of this for me. What differences or challenges do you see for someone that thinks that they fit for 35 years? Maybe obvious who I'm talking about. And then all of a sudden you realize, oh my gosh, I don't fit. What do you think that there's a difference of approach?
There's a huge difference, yeah. So I would love to talk about that for a minute. So I'm a moderator for the A Thoughtful Faith support group online. And the experience that has been for me has been so eye-opening, and it's precisely because of what you're talking about. So I'm in this community of people where I would say a big majority of them are there because they were going along, and it was great, and then suddenly it wasn't. And so people bring up things in that group all the time, and I think, were we even raised in the same church? What are you talking about? You believed all that stuff? I don't even know what you're talking about. I really have no frame of reference for so many people's experience in the church, because I literally cannot remember a time when I wasn't just like, you know, I can't remember a time. I don't feel like I have had any kind of faith crisis, faith transition, journey, whatever. The only difference for me is that I've started opening my mouth, and I realize that that marks me as very different from a lot of people who are in this space. So it's been a really great expanding experience for me to connect with people like you and realize that, yeah, I am not the norm, and that I need to learn how to take my own ability to navigate the uncomfortable things, because I've been doing it for so many years. I need to harness that to be able to help pull other people through that, because it's debilitating to people. It obliterates lives, families, marriages. This is serious. What's going on is serious. So I want to help. Anybody else?
Thank you for sharing your personal story, and you definitely covered a lot of ground, and just lots of topics could come up from, you know, being, you know, you've traversed the country with your family, and then, you know, new territory, you know, with the divorces and in your children, that must be very, very painful. Early in your marriage, you talked about that you had, you know, some fights about this, you know, the gender
power struggle,
the gender expectations. Yeah. You know, can your husband iron his own shirt to get ready to go? Those kind of things.
Yep.
Clean the house. I attended Community of Christ for 2 years, and last night we had at the Prince lecture. I don't know if you were in attendance, but
yes,
they had they sang their nameplate hymn For Everyone Born, mm-hmm. which talks about revising the gender roles.
Right.
That's one of the verses. And my basic question is that, you know, just about equality, that you obviously are an excellent person. You graduated at age 19 with children. So that's above and beyond what men are expected to do in this culture, you know, that the men say, okay, you are, take care of this. Darn my socks, iron my shirts, clean the house. And don't expect to have any outside, you know, interaction. Isolate yourself in this world of motherhood. And my own mother said that if she had been forced into that role, she would have gone crazy. You know, so she stands as a model for me, as someone that, you know, says, I don't need to have these roles. And so, like, a lot of times when she's in Relief Society, she has to bite her tongue because of the right-wing politics that will be forced and it's just...
Yeah, it's hard being a woman in the church.
Comment on how you... Any any type of accommodate. You, the thing that was missing in your speech was how you've accommodated between you and your husband.
Okay.
After that first fight.
Yeah, happy to address that. I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage here because my husband's mother is in the audience, so you know, I have to be nice. And I'm going to be 100% honest with you right now and tell you that she raised a remarkable man. And this could never have worked. I have told my daughters every day of their lives, this only works because you marry Russ Hinckley. This is the only reason that any of this works. It's the only way you get to be a crazy artist lady, hang out, do whatever you want. You know, I mean, this only works under this scenario. So you got to find Russ Hinckley if you want to be able to. So all that is true. But yeah, I did have, you know, I was super fast tracking it through my life. Up through age 19, had all kinds of goals, all kinds of things. In a bizarre twist, I made a decision to be a stay-at-home mom. That also had tremendous meaning for me as a result of experiences that I had had as a child. That was a very specific decision that I made. It was unexpected, even to me, but I was deeply committed to it, and yet it kind of went against everything that I was doing, and I think that accounts for the 9 years of, you know, just failure to fully come to grips with the decision I'd made, where I was in the world, and, you know, what was going on. And so he was very keenly aware of all those things, keenly aware of the ways in which I had stepped off my own track, keenly aware of the sacrifices that I was making for the family. I have always called myself the facilitator. We have moved all over this doggone country. He has been able to take any job that he wanted. We're all on Team Hinckley. We've all been building his resume for 37 years. I'm all for it because it facilitates my life as well. You know, this is a role that I willingly stepped into. Along the way, I've been able to have an art career. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's worked really beautifully for me. But it was hard to find my footing in that space. And I will tell you, that is pretty easy to get my hackles up in Relief Society when gender role discussions do not go the way that I want them to go. And I know that from the outside, people probably look at me and think, what are you talking about? Like, you got married at 18, you stayed home with your kids, you know, I'm sure that I look maybe disingenuous sometimes in some of my views, but I feel like my own journey as a woman in the church has been pretty unconventional despite what it looks like from the outside. So I don't know if that helps, but thank you for telling me that was missing from the story. I appreciate that. I appreciate the opportunity to fill that in. So
I'm Bruce Van Orden. My wife, Karen, and I are now in our 70s. We've been trying to be understanding of other people's victimhood. Early on, I worked hard in the race and the priesthood issue, even in conventional settings. I've strive to be an advocate of gender equality, and I'm now engaged, like many of you here, with helping our friends in the LGBTQ family. And yet we went to a session yesterday late in the afternoon where the young people were telling us that the allies and the liberals are causing more trouble for them than the conservatives, and it's really been hurtful because we've worked hard and we may not understand completely, but to be told that you're not helping, how do you deal with this? Or have you ever been told you're not assisting when you're really trying?
Yeah, I get told it all the time because I am a moderator in an online group, and the online world belongs to people not of my generation. They invented it after I had already left the building. So, you know, now I'm hanging out with these people trying to help them along and, you know, just literally making a mess of it just about every time I open my mouth. So I spend as much time feeling bad about what I just said and trying to figure out why it landed so badly, you know, trying to just, like, they change the vocabulary faster than I can keep up with it. I don't know, you know, what's the correct terminology for it. I literally make a mess of it all the time. And it is hard and it is hurtful because, you know, like at age 55, I feel like, man, I'm finally getting stuff figured out. Can I not somehow contribute this somewhere or, you know, share it. But on the other hand, if I'm not helpful, if I'm not helpful in the fight, I don't want to make it worse for those people. So I don't really have any kind of answer or advice for you except to say, I feel you. I am living that every day, and it's hard and it's frustrating, and I only hope that our love and our message, you know, can transcend our clumsy feet. That's all I can really say about it. Thanks for being in the fight.
I have kind of a quick question, which you've addressed somewhat. You talk a little bit about using your voice now, and mm-hmm. part of what had kind of an epiphany that part of what would scare me about not being part of the church is losing my voice. I feel like in the church, you know, if I teach young women, I have access to these young women and teach them what I wish I had known, and if I'm sitting through Sunday school, sometimes whisper screaming to my husband about something that's bothering me, and I'll get a Sunday school teacher who comes up to me and says, I appreciate your comments, will you substitute for me? And I'm like, me lead the discussion? Yes, so I don't have to whisper scream at my husband all afternoon. I'm just
that's
definitely
awesome.
Going to lead this the way I want it to go. But how do you find your voice now that my voice has changed? Because like many people, you know, I was toe the line until I hit about 40. Keep contributing your voice without, I feel like we run a pretty tight line where we can contribute our voice within the paradigm and still change the paradigm. Like, how do you find that balance?
So I don't know which, I have no idea which episode of Mormon Matters it was on, but Dan was talking about this with somebody at some time, and it literally stopped me on my walk because it was so brilliant. But he was talking about how, I think we're talking about literal interpretation of the scriptures versus a, you know, more metaphorical interpretation or something. But he was talking about how when he makes a comment, when he approaches it, the specific way in which he is able to leave space for the literal believers in the room, right? And it just sort of obliterates that either-or kind of paradigm that we have set up. And I think if you know Dan, then it's easy to believe that he's extraordinarily gifted at that. But that really is my goal, right? These are my people. I love them. I choose to be here. I want to contribute. And I'm keenly aware that opening your mouth is a hard thing because once you lose influence, if you lose influence in your ward, it is over. It's over. So I had a really good friend in Chicago years ago, it was in the mid-90s, and she went on a little crusade about the line. You know the children's song, I love to look for rainbows whenever there's rain, right? So there's that line in there that is bad theology, bad theology, bad theology, right? I know when I'm baptized, my wrongs are washed away. Well, you know, why are we teaching eight-year-olds that, anyway, right? So it's a problem. So she wrote a letter about it. She went on this little crusade. It was a very small crusade, but, you know, it went to her stake president. All the things that happened. Literally, she was over in that ward. She was finished. And she is one of the smartest women that I have ever known in the church. And it was terrifying to me. It was terrifying to me. And I took that lesson well to heart. I have been, you know, dancing around this line for many, many years, and I'm good at it, man. I know exactly how far I can step, but I'm trying to step a little further than is comfortable for me or for the other people in the room. And if I get called into my bishop's office every now and then, you know what? Okay, I'm confident in my beliefs. I have shown up all these years. I've done what you asked me to do. I'm trying to stay. Work with me. That's what I've got. So I'm still super sensitive to where the lines are. Super sensitive. And I think that's important. I want to maintain influence. So. Is that it? Thank you so much for coming. Thank you for allowing me to share my story. You're very kind.